Architecture Talks, the podcast about architecture from Jung.
We think that life is very short and that we really need to be passionate about what we do. Otherwise, it will be a drag.
Linda Neri and Rosanna Hu's projects are in a category of their own, both stylistically and in terms of the construction task. Their work, whether accessories, furniture, design, interior design, architecture, or master planning, fascinates at different levels and is characterized by good design. For them, architecture is an expression of what we are. They are individuals whose history also includes a constant focus on contrasting cultures. Interdisciplinarity is a success factor, but so are sensitivity and courage for dealing with what is already there and for experimenting with new ways of living. Today in our podcast, Linda Neri and Rosanna Hu give us, Diana Slavik and
Katrina Beatrice Varga, insights into their approach, role models, and architecture's responsibility. Founded in 2004 by the partners Linda Neri and Rosanna Hu, Neri and Hu Design and Research Office is an interdisciplinary architectural design practice based in Shanghai. The practice's burgeoning global portfolio includes commissions ranging from master planning and architecture to interior design, installation, furniture, product, branding, as well as graphic works. Currently working on projects in many countries, Neri and Hu is composed of multicultural staff who speak over 30 languages. The diversity of the team reinforces a core vision for the practice. To respond to a global worldview, incorporating overlapping design disciplines for a new paradigm in architecture. Hello and welcome to our Jung Architecture Talks podcast. It's so nice to have you with us.
It's nice to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
Likewise, it's nice meeting you guys.
You founded your studio in Shanghai in 2004. A lot has happened since then. What do you consider to have been your office's most important milestone regarding projects and designs?
Several different ones, right? Not just one, in terms of milestones. Well, definitely our very first project that got quite a lot of international media, design media coverage. And it happened to be actually this office's very first project. It's an interior project called Y Plus Yoga. And then the second project that became kind of more widely popular was the Water House. And that happened to be our very first architecture project. It had interior components, but also the first time that we, you know, engaged in architecture. And then I think product-wise, we designed very early on, I think one of our first or second product design project was the Zisha series, using purple clay to make kind of very modern and minimalist clean lines using that traditional and ancient material. So I would say those three kind of interior and architecture and product design, they were defining moments of the kind of work that we did later on.
We'd like to talk about a project, the Papi restaurant in Paris. Here on just 52 square meters of space, several of your office's principles are ingeniously combined. Your focus is on cultural heritage, the reading of material layers, and a daring structural expansion without negating history. In addition, as part of your work for De La Espada, you had the opportunity to design a chair specifically for the needs of the Papi restaurants. A perfect match? And how did this project come about? And what would you say is so special about it for you?
This project was quite interesting, and people often wonder why we even took on such a small project. The client, the restaurateur, really loved what we do. He had written us many times and followed us and me and Rosanna in Instagram. But more importantly, he had an interesting vision. He said that he was interested in the notion of not so much an interdisciplinary, but the play of different palette within the culinary world. So he was interested in hiring a Japanese chef who was experimenting on Italian pizza in a French location. So we found that quite fascinating. Initially, he thought it would be too small for us to be interested in, but he wrote us quite a long brief of his passion, his interest. And to our surprise, aside from the fact that he had some question on the signage and maybe some of the kitchen kind of relationship with the restaurant, many of our decisions he really respected. And we found that including the customization of this particular chair.
Yeah, the furniture.
Which was to make it really small in order for the space as a whole to feel a little bit more expansive. And so that in itself was quite interesting. It was challenging, but he was adamant in making sure that within this 52 square meter, that we engage all of our interests within our practice. And so you guys read it quite correctly in terms of the reading of the heritage, the play on materiality, the challenges we had on the structural, and yet the layering is quite obvious if you go there. And what's even more important, and we're very happy, is it's a very popular restaurant.
Yeah, and I think this project really happened, it opened right before
COVID.
And the whole kind of timing and condition of which it came about, there's so many things about the project that was just absolutely unexpected. And if things didn't happen the way it did, it probably would not have worked. So we happened to be in Paris. It wasn't for the project, but we happened to be in Paris. And then we went to see the site. We met the owner, really only one or two meetings. And then we started designing. So it's just a lot of chance things that happened. And then also, I think designing of this chair, we were not expecting to design a chair for this restaurant, but because everything that we try to put in there was too big. You know how Paris is, it's, you know, very tight condition. And then I remember we said, well, why don't we just design something that is small, that fits into the character of the design. And then also we happened to have a very senior project manager designer who was based in Paris. So if he doesn't live there and he's not in charge of the project, this also would not have happened. But his team is in Shanghai and he's been there for a few years. You know, he didn't go there for the project, but it just turned out to be kind of quite perfect. And then the production of the chair was done by a brand in London, but their production is in Portugal. Our design team is here. And during COVID, they're able to send things to Paris from Portugal to test it out. And it was like, you know, last minute, right before they opened, they were shipping the chairs in. So just so many things just like happened quite perfectly.
Just to give our listeners a little picture of our recording, we just saw Lyndon dancing with a little chair and it's really, really wonderful. You seem to like it a lot because it's a really wonderful chair. And actually, Deanne and me, we live 3 hours with the train from Paris, and I think we will visit the restaurant.
Yes.
Yeah, we're still expecting to have the pizza. We haven't yet tried the pizza. We're here.
The Japanese one.
Yes, the Japanese French pizza.
That sounds like a fantastic mix. I mean, within like the kitchen idea, but also the design idea. So intercultural, interdisciplinary mix, which seems to fit perfectly. That's fantastic.
Did you have to work with any new materials you did not know before?
The tile we make here in China, if you look at the tile, it's kind of vaulted. So curved. It's curved. So from the picture, you can't quite tell. In real life, it's interesting. It was a Chinese restaurant before that. You can imagine. Yeah. It's hilarious. Okay. And it was so enclosed. And so the first thing we did was we stripped it open and kept the existing structure. Initially, it did not pass planning because the planning, look at it, and it's like, why are you trying to keep it raw? I remember I had to record a presentation and they were kind of surprised the sensitivity that we were interested in to bring sort of the patina of the neighbor into the context of the elevation that we designed.
So it doesn't really have to do anything if it's 52 square meters or bigger. Your enthusiasm is just equally for the project.
Yes, we actually have a lot of sketches for this particular project. It was the smallest project, but per square meter, we probably have more sketches. We were sketching away in Paris, remember? Mm-hmm. We were really focusing. I mean, for Rosanna and myself, I think oftentimes we think that life is very short and that we really need to be passionate about what we do. Otherwise, it will be a drag. It will be a burden to a certain extent. And then becomes difficult. Then when you start saying, well, it's okay, let's just let it go, it actually becomes a burden, becomes a chore. And we always question ourselves. This morning, Rosanna was just questioning me about the fact that, you know, are we going to do this project? Are we really going to do this project? And so that constant kind of introspection is very important within the practice.
Yeah, I mean, your work on projects is at all levels, right? So from accessories to master planning, without pinning yourselves down to one typology or style. And you obviously work very analytically and emotionally, also referring to movies. How do you approach new construction tasks? Does the size of the project make a difference when it comes to your design strategy?
I think by virtue of the size, for sure, there will be difference. But in terms of the approach and the very start of every project, trying to find meaning and trying to find the reason behind what we are doing, engaging the client in conversation and making sure that they actually understand what they want to do, what their purpose is, and perhaps we can try to, together with them, find meaning and purpose. You know, we have this quote by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry that we always like. He once said that we do not aspire to be eternal beings. We only hope that things do not lose its meaning and purpose. And I think in a world where things are moving so fast, where the technological world have detached us from our everyday and the mundane and the ordinary things, we have to actually be very conscious in finding the poetry of the everyday.
Rosanna, you seem to agree what Lyndon said.
I totally agree. And I think we see every project as an opportunity to try something new, to experiment, and to also establish a different thesis. And that's why I think even whether we are designing a chair or a new city, the scales obviously are very different and we have to consider functional difference. But the thesis could take on, you know, very similar kind of importance and significance.
And when you talk about films, it's not just film, it's literature. We look at art a lot. Rosanna is really into music. I try to get my fascination with sports into architecture. That's a little bit hard. That's a little bit harder. Perhaps the notion of speed and the notion of redundancy and sort of discipline and practice that we teach as well. And now what happened is we actually force our students to read not just literature, fiction, but also essays and film. In fact, this morning, Rosanna just suggested to one of the students to look at one of the films that would or could potentially help these students work.
Yeah, because the process of design could be very abstract in the beginning when you're looking for the idea. And the idea could be philosophical, could be form, it could be poetic, it could be structural, it could be so many different things. And it's very hard to, especially now that we're teaching design, it's very hard to tell a student, oh, you know, you have to design like this.
Yeah.
Then you might as well just draw it for them. Then you're not teaching.
Yeah.
But how do you teach design? You have to help them think about what they want to design, what they want to draw, how to make that form. And then it's
about, keep them open-minded, right?
Yeah, finding references for them. And then hopefully they will think of the reference and come up with their own idea. And then if they're happy and satisfied and it's a great idea, then we've succeeded in teaching.
It was interesting. I just finished a presentation for a small retreat about 3 hours away here from Shanghai. The client, we had given them three different schemes. I was not very happy. They were already happy by the second scheme, but I was still not happy. So usually it's the client who would approve, but I was not ready for them to submit to the government official. And today was the fourth scheme. And I started by saying, after we all die, which is a rather morbid way to start this presentation, I said, it's our responsibility to the next generation, our responsibility to the land. And it was interesting because both owners came. It's a joint venture. And after the presentation was over, and they were rather emotional, and they said, thank you. They called me Guo Laoshi, you know, teacher Guo. That's my Chinese last name. Thank you for such a moving presentation. We like it not because it's aesthetically beautiful, because everything you do, we always like. But you, every single time we come here, you made us think. There are two very wealthy individuals. One is in the roofing industry, and the other one is in the hemp industry. Imagine both of them coming together to do a retreat. And for them to say, you know, thank you for challenging us about our contribution back to the world that has given us much. Now, that might sound a little bit cliche, but as cliche as that sounds, there's a lot of truth to that. And I think as humanity, if people start taking cliches seriously and actually dig deep and really try to understand the purpose in what they are, why they are where they are today, and what the purpose is for them in this short life, then we will be in a better world.
That somehow what we discovered while browsing your website, many of your projects, you have included your link from art, architecture, film, etc. And for example, Helmut Newton's photographs with a waterhouse at South Bund, or Alfred Hitchcock's 1954 film Rear Window for the Split House in Tianzifang. Who and what inspires you? Like, you explained it already a little bit, but do you have like persons or special, yeah, inspirations?
I think we have sort of our favorite list of artists and writers, musicians, things that inspire us. But also, I think more than these, we're also very inspired just by a lot of mundane things, that like places we pass by. We like to find things from unexpected places. So when we first moved to Shanghai about 20 years ago, we just found the city to be fascinating. Things that you probably pass by every day, and people who have lived here for a long time, they don't even see anymore. And then we see, you know, the way that the underwear is hung in the windows. I don't know if you know, they hang their clothesliner, and then there's this like bamboo stick where they reach out like 3 meters long, and then they can like grab things. I mean, those things are like about daily life and local culture and the intelligence of, you know, living tools. Those things are actually really exciting for us to find and discover. So I think it's a combination of many different things.
I think we are blessed, both Rosanna and I. In many ways, we're both very curious individuals, and we're constantly challenging ourselves. Obviously, traveling helps. And even without traveling, we both love reading. We love going to museums, and we're constantly provoking each other by asking each other questions that we might not necessarily be aware of. So this curiosity brings about a certain kind of phenomena of wanting to learn more. We don't just stop in sort of exploring, thinking to ourselves, we already know it. I think the humility to know that we actually are far from knowing many of the things that was before us and potentially what is ahead of us. So teaching is very much a responsibility, but at the same time, we're also learning from the younger generation. We love reading books because if you are only interested in the today and the experience of today, oftentimes you forget sort of the many thinkings and the inventions of the past. By reading, going back to history, it allows you to have that conversation with many generations before you. You could be reading some of what Borromini talks about, and you'll be able to have a glimpse of what Renaissance stands for. And, you know, if you read what John Son, I mean, I'm just talking about architecture world, but imagine the literature world and all that. It brings about a certain richness, and this richness allows you to be humble, to stay humble, because you realize the more you know, the more you read, the more you realize you don't know much.
Talking about materials and surfaces, they play an important role in your designs. And the range of materials isn't opulent, but rather very clear and reduced, as we already talked about. A space-creating sculpture grows out of a filigree brass railing, or the massiveness of a large volume is dissolved into a textile-like garment through the alternating arrangement of the bricks. Do you actually have your favorite materials or something you emphasize on working with special materials?
I don't think I have a favorite material, but I have my own idea of how to use any material. I tend to like things that are natural and expressed in its most natural and raw state. So I remember when we first started working with projects in China, at that time, the wood finish we were looking for was not used anywhere by anyone. And when you explain to a contractor, okay, I want this to be very raw finish, when you touch the wood, it feels like wood. And they're like, what are you talking about? Because all the wood has this lacquer. It just feels like nail polish, glossy. And they think if you don't have it, it's not protected. And I'm trying to tell them, you know, sometimes, especially small surfaces, the oil in your hand, if you touch it, it actually has a nice patina, like leather also. It's okay that the touch of the hand, or, you know, when you sit on a chair, that marking of time is really beautiful. And people don't understand what we're talking about. And so I think I will always remember that period in this location where everything has to be protected, and they feel like if, you know, there's a protective coating, then it's more precious. I think time has really changed. I think now, you know, you can find really beautiful wood products. So whether it's metal or wood or stone, we really just like the most kind of raw state. But at the same time, we also use mirror, we use, you know, plastic. We try not to, glass, you know, more industrial material, but always in kind of conjunction with the very natural material.
We also are fascinated with a number of things when it comes to material. Naturally, we're often, and you will see in a lot of our work, that reuse and recycle notion of materials. I think that plays an important role in many of our new projects. Partially, it's also our statement on this new vernacular architecture that we're exploring. It's not just typology, it's also material. I think generally we're also more interested in the congregation of smaller materials coming together, a community of materials, say tiles, brick, glass blocks, that as a whole, as a community together, forming into one, a bigger whole. Less interested, not that we don't do it, but less interested in sort of the prima donna of materials. So let me explain that a little bit to you. So for instance, a big piece of marble, just to showcase sort of the size and the wealth of this particular piece, or wood that gets cut off, big pieces of wood, and people put it like one big table. Not that we don't do it. If we're given that opportunity, we probably will, but it's not our focus. You know, some people tend to want to showcase sort of the grandness or the length or the super hugeness of one piece of stone or wood. That to us is not as interesting.
Let's focus on the keywords vernacular and adaptive reuse. You already mentioned it. You have it in your current exhibition, and you're looking for ways in which architecture and the built environment can better respond to our changing needs and sometimes even anticipate them. So what have been your findings so far from the exhibition?
I think so far, it's not just our exhibition. The exhibition now has become this book, our second monograph. I don't know if you've seen this yet. Yeah, well, this is actually limited edition, so you will see the other version. But we realize, contrary to perhaps what we think, that a lot of people are actually quite interested in a lot of the issues that we've been exploring. What was perhaps considered poor, the idea of reuse, the idea of vernacular seems parochial and poor, is now not necessarily fashionable, but now is seen as perhaps something urgent, something needed, that is required of a heritage that could potentially be lost if they're not careful. I'm really encouraged by the younger generation who came to the exhibition, who bought our books, who came to the book launch, and all they said was, thank you for leading this charge. Thank you for being so brave in being able to make things that potentially could be commercially not viable, because we've lost quite a few projects. After Waterhouse, I still remember we lost two huge projects because the clients just basically told us, like, I don't think you guys were the right architects. I mean, that was shocking for me, actually. At that time, our practice was only about 15 people, and I was ready to cut the practice by half, right? Just because it was quite precarious. We actually did not bounce back until 2 years later.
Yeah, I think it really started with something that is more intuitive than anything. We're just naturally drawn to those materials and aesthetic. And then we started when I think Waterhouse came through, and that gave us an opportunity to really study and think deeply about renovation and memory of a city and remnants and ruins in a city. And what do you do with it? And Waterhouse was a project when the client came to us, he wanted us to demolish. He said, you know, just demolish everything and then build a new project. And we went to the site. It was the very first time we went to the site, and we looked at ourselves like, it's so interesting to walk around the site and like go upstairs. I just like stop. And, you know, if you go further, you like drop. And we just couldn't like stop moving around the building inside. And we thought, well, this is what traveling is about. And it's designing, you know, for travelers, for a hotel, a 19-room hotel. And we thought, well, why don't we just like leave a lot of the spaces as is rather than designing anything new? Of course, there were a lot of new components. You know, you have to make things work. But that attitude was totally intuitive. But then later on, we also, you know, read more about the subject. And then, you know, we established sort of this connection with something theorized by Svetlana Bohm, who talked about reflective nostalgia. So, I mean, you know, we've lectured a lot about the subject, but initially it was really just kind of an intuitive thinking that this is the right way to approach. And then more and more projects came to us that had to deal with similar ideas. And therefore, we just feel it's really important to consider these subjects because, especially I think today with digital age, with everybody looking towards the future, it's not that we don't want to look towards the future, but we feel like people are kind of forgetting who they are, identity, culture, background, history. And we're just looking for a way to kind of move towards the future and bringing those things with us, right?
Also, I think what was important was Aldo Rossi's sort of thinking. When we were in school in the US, his influence was really strong. And he talks about the collective memory and how the collective memory is very important for every city. And that's the reason, obviously, he argues that's the reason why monuments exist. And it's not so much that we want to create a monument, but I think the collective memory of the alleyways, the lane houses is just as important. The interstitial spaces are just as important as the high rises across the river that people seem to be so fascinated with. People are either looking at the bun with all the 33 historical buildings or the new gleaming high rises. And what happened is all the interstitial spaces, all the in-between are left over to be demolished, either that or are rotted beyond recognition. And yet they comprise the collective memory of the everyday, the community. And that's where we need to focus on, because that actually affects 90% of the population.
And that is something everyone is fascinating about while traveling, no? I mean, we want to see the traditional architecture, the traditional areas within the cities or spaces. I remember my first time in China, I went to Beijing, was like 12, 13 years ago, and I was able to stay within the first quarter in the Hutong area, which was amazing because I love to walk through every day and just like see how daily life is working. And what you explained before, Rosanna, when they're hanging out their clothes and finding their solutions just to work with it in the daily life, that was so fascinating. And of course, at the same time, high rises are super fascinating for us Germans, as we are not used to have such tall, huge projects within Germany. But the Hutongs are something very emotional. That's something very human. And that somehow makes you understand the people and the tradition and the culture a little bit better. You can find it anywhere. I mean, traveling to Italy, to France, to wherever. We talked about Vienna before. That's what we're always looking for, you know, for the like a little bit historical base human areas.
But it's also interesting, Dijon, because Nabokov once said that everything new today will be considered history tomorrow.
That's right. Yes.
Paraphrasing this, obviously. So the very essence of all the high-rises in Putong, when we say history, we're not dismissing Putong, because Putong is a new modernity, a new China. We're in all these high-rises. There will be values associated with these high-rises as well. I mean, if New York City remained low-rise, then you would not have the Manhattan today. And oftentimes, people think of Manhattan as a modern condition, which it is, right? And oftentimes when people do high-rises in China or in Asia, people always say, oh, that's so New York. Well, it is actually not so much New York, but it is during that time the economy was growing in that particular city. If it happens to be in Shanghai in the 30s or the 40s, then perhaps the high-rises will be in Shanghai or in Bangkok or in, you know, other places as opposed to New York, right? So the idea of it is so New York, it is so Paris, it is so Amsterdam. The idea is to understand what that means rather than just using a catchphrase. And that's very dangerous. And that's why we often challenge our client and challenge ourselves, so we don't get so hang up with the terminology without really understanding the essence.
And I, okay, now that I'm speaking to a German lady, I think of a German word, maybe one of the few words I know. So I think Zeitgeist, the spirit of the time, really kind of defined this thing that we're talking about. It's not just the locality and the culture, but it's also a very specific period in that culture.
Yeah, I mean, also connecting the local thinking, right? Not only the terms of the city, but also connecting the locals with the city. And that's why it is so important to also connect with the people.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm sorry, I said two German lady. I meant one German and one Austrian. Very sorry.
Thank you so much for
actually,
respect.
I'm not German as well. Don't worry. I'm born in Germany, but my parents are from Serbia, actually. So I have like Yugoslav origins.
So we are an international podcast team here.
Like
Konstantin
Grichik.
There we go. Yes.
Lyndon and Rosanna, we have one more question about your office. You studied and worked in the US, and now you work in an interdisciplinary international team in Shanghai with your clients coming from all genders and cultures. Is this cultural melting pot kind of a part of your recipe for success?
Yeah, first of all, it's not a melting pot. It's a salad bowl. The difference between a melting pot and a salad bowl is, I mean, this is from my Asian Studies 101 from Berkeley. The melting pot is when different things go in and then they all kind of melt, become something different, like a hybrid. But salad bowl, a potato and a tomato and apple and lettuce, you know, they retain their identity.
Yeah, they retain the diversity.
I don't know if it contributes to the so-called success, but it definitely makes working here much more invigorating and exciting and inspiring, because when we, you know, work together on a project, we hear voices and opinions from different backgrounds. And it's not just, you know, what we think, Rosanna and Lyndon, but it's always a teamwork. And the more diverse ideas are, the richer the content.
I think the word recipe might not necessarily be one I would use, but I think what's interesting
is... For salad, you need a recipe.
Yes.
At least for the dressing.
That's right. We encourage, because we're just curious individuals. There is no such thing as a bad culture or a good culture when I talk about countries. So we're always interested in many different issues. And because we are fascinated with many different philosophers from all kinds of nations, different thinkers, different fiction writers, different painters. By virtue of that, naturally, we become very curious and interested, and we have really engaged conversation with clients. And I think even during competitions or interviews, it becomes easier for them to relate to us, perhaps, as individuals that are truly interested in breaking the cultural barriers of where we are and where we're heading to. And I think maybe because of that, people are more comfortable. Like our students at Harvard right now, many kids are quite brilliant. You know, they're, what do they call?
Third culture kids.
Third culture kids. So just when you think you can speak two languages, many of them can speak five, six. You know, it's so normal. And it's invigorating to see how the world is changing, where the borders are now getting really blurry.
There's a book on the topic, Third Culture Kids. I'm actually reading it. It's really good.
Huh, interesting to hear that.
Well, we do see the change. When we were going to school in the U.S., we would probably comprise 5% of the population in the graduate program, probably even less.
Asian.
Yeah. We're not even talking about Chinese. We talk about Asian, meaning Korean, Japanese, yeah. Thai, you know. But
just
now,
like black hair.
Yeah. But now some of these top architecture school master's program, I would say over 50%. And of the 50%, maybe 20-25% are coming from China. And it is phenomenal. And some of them, their ability and their dexterity to be able to kind of move between one language to another in really high-level conversation is extremely impressive.
Yes, absolutely. So we talked about many projects and topics, and we're coming to the end of this podcast. And actually, I would have two questions.
Personal questions, not about the office.
Personal, yeah. One would be, is there any message you would like to send out to our young audience, like the young architects and designers, to maybe encourage them from your experience? And another one, we would like to know if there is a contemporary building you would like to have built by your own.
Wow, very two very intriguing questions. Both answers from both of us?
You can answer, of course, both of you.
That's good. Two questions makes four answers. That's pretty good.
For me, the answer for the younger designer or younger person, I would encourage them to first find themselves and know who they are. I feel like, especially in design and architecture, if you don't know who you are and if you don't have a strong understanding of your own identity, whether it's culture, personal history, or, you know, whatnot, then you would not know where to go with your design. So really seek internally at the same time that you're looking, you know, in the outer world for different kinds of inspiration.
I think for the younger generation, and this is something I would probably speak to a younger Lyndon, would be to be humble, to really understand the essence of what humility brings to humanity. And I think when you're humble, you become curious. When you're humble, you're ready to listen. When you're humble, you are always thinking about other people as opposed to yourselves. And when you're humble, the many things you do, be it architecture or your artwork or your writing, will have a deep impact with humanity, more than sort of the spectacle that the narrative of this world often would like you to have.
And now the second question.
Did you say contemporary project?
Yes. Or it could be also a future or past, whatever is coming into your mind.
It's hard because I would not say one.
Yeah, there's so many. Yes, I totally.
There we go.
I think if you look at the Salk Institute in La Jolla by Louis Kahn, if you look at the IIT building by Omnibad by Louis Kahn, or the mill owners by Le Corbusier, or the St. Peter or St. Mark's by Leverett.
I think it's endless.
I think I would love to have four or five of those buildings under my belt, more than just one. Yes. It is looking at these buildings that made you realize, often when I see this, in fact, we were in India, we were in Ahmedabad, and Rosanna and I saw mill owners by Le Corbusier. We saw the other house, Chauban House, and then we saw the IIT, and then we saw another Louis Kahn building in Chandigarh. Every single time we go to these buildings, we get so dejected. And oftentimes I would tell Rosanna, let's stop practicing. We have not moved a needle the last 50 to 60 years. Every time I go there, we both get really depressed because we're like, man, these guys have done it so well. We have not even arrived at that level. What are we doing? And of course, when we come out and we see a lot of the bad buildings and we're like, okay, maybe we still should do it.
You should definitely.
Please do not stop. Please don't.
Yes. But yes, that's a constant struggle for both of us. Every time we see good work, as much as we like to see good work, I mean, a lot of the new work by Valerio Olgiati, by people like Peter Zumthor, people like Caruso St. John, many of these very serious architects have really made us question about ourselves and our process.
I could imagine. I have to say, I'm very touched. I feel very honored being able to speak with you, getting like inspired by you. Thank you so much for your open words. It's just a pleasure speaking to you. And we really, really hope that you do not stop your work, even though you're visiting Louis Kahn another time. Please stay like you are, stay curious and encourage all the young people just to be brave and humble, as you said.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, my feelings about this conversation is actually a salad bowl of impression, of honor, and curiosity. So thank you very much. Greetings to Shanghai, and it was a great pleasure talking and listening to you. To say it in Chinese, Shai Jian.
How do you say goodbye in German?
Auf Wiedersehen.
Auf Wiedersehen. We'll have to learn a few more German words.
Well, your pronunciation on Zeitgeist was perfect.
Oh, that's an easy one. It was a pleasure for us.
Thank you.
And many thanks to our listeners as well. And we're looking forward to share our upcoming Jung Architecture Talks podcast with all of you. Tune in on jung.de/architects.